You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 339. And in this one, I interview Dr. Heather Sequeira. Heather is a consultant psychologist based in the UK, and I got her on specifically to talk about trauma and OCD. Now, of course, trauma is a massive topic that I could probably cover over hundreds of episodes, but this episode does a good job, I feel, at answering some of those questions and getting the ball rolling, and I will look to cover the variations of trauma in much more detail in the future. But in particular, we discuss her therapy story, so what got her to be a psychologist, and specifically with trauma and OCD. She shares what is post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. We discuss what is complex or developmental trauma, what's going on in the brain with trauma. We look at disgust in trauma and OCD, doubt and uncertainty. We also discuss treating OCD and trauma together, the role of compassion, when the OCD theme directly links to the trauma, focusing on what we want to do now and our values, and shame around the freeze response. I really enjoyed chatting with Heather, and I think you guys will enjoy the conversation. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective, and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories, or the link will be in the episode description. So thank you again to Heather for her time and expertise. And of course, thank you to you guys for listening. As always, I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here's Heather. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Hello. Hi, Stuart. Really good to be here.
It's good to have you on. And of course, background, how I met you or know you, I did one of your trauma trainings.
Yes.
And happened to, I think, in one of the breaks of that training, Google you, as I'm sure everyone does. And then I noticed that one of your specialties was in trauma and OCD. So that really intrigued me. So I got in touch with you after the training to invite you on the show. So it's good to have you here.
Absolutely. Glad you did, Stuart.
Thank you. So the first question I always like to ask professionals or therapists or psychologists, psychiatrists is why this profession and why OCD?
That's a really good question. I think as a child, I was always really fascinated by connections. So connections between people. Connections between people's actions and how they felt, and also particularly, I think, connections between people's life events, what happened to them and how that ended up affecting them later. So I was kind of just curious about all that growing up as a young person. So psychology was the natural thing to want to go into as an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. I think when I got there, two things really. One was that I had some personal experiences of OCD when I was a student. And so that made me really interested in anything to do with mental health, but particularly the OCD bits. And also we had some great lecturers. One in particular was telling us not just about the facts and the figures and the statistics about OCD and other mental health problems, but really told us stories. So hopefully these are all done with his patient's permission. But yeah, loads of stuff around how OCD really played havoc with people's lives, how it could really disable people. And yet there were therapies, treatments, things that really skilled clinicians could do to help people compassionately and kindly and just really well get over these kind of problems and start living their lives again in the ways that they wanted to. So this was really inspiring to me, and that set me off on the journey of wanting to study OCD more and to just really work in that way in the future. So that was the OCD bit. Yeah, I think the trauma bit came a bit later. Do you want to know about that bit?
Yeah, please, go for it.
Okay, so I think the trauma bit really came about before I did my training, before I did training as a psychologist. And I was working on a couple of charities. One was for people with learning disabilities, And one was for people with very enduring, long-standing mental health problems. And what I noticed was that all the service users, unanimously all the service users that I was working with, had vast histories of aversive life events and traumas. And these seemed to be really, really connected to the kind of mental health problems that they were experiencing. But this was, remember, this was back in the late 90s, because I'm quite old, early 2000s. Our society wasn't particularly trauma-informed then, and people didn't readily see the links between things that we'd been through and how it affected us in terms of our behaviour, our thinking and our emotions back then. We weren't really seeing, people were, if we had a mental health problem, we were being looked at in terms of what was wrong with us rather than what had happened to us. So that made a lot of sense to me to try and turn that round in my own head. So not what's wrong with us, but what has happened to us. So looking at it very much from that point of view. So that took me into research. So I wanted to do a PhD in trauma. So I went to St George's Medical School in London, which is part of University of London, to do a PhD. And then I spent the next 7 years doing academic research in the area of trauma. So I feel really privileged to have had that opportunity, both to done training as a psychologist, but also how to have that really solid background in research, because I think there's a lot that I can bring, you know, first of all, in terms of the quality of my own life, but mainly to, you know, help other people, to the quality of other people's lives and to help them live the kind of lives that they want to live. So that's my history, really.
Brilliant. Thank you for sharing. And at what point for you in your career did trauma and OCD intersect?
Yeah, I suppose it was a gradual thing all the way through, in that I was seeing the links between what happened to people and the kind of, you know, mental health problems, if any, that people developed from that. And it was when I started working for the NHS, I started working as a specialist psychologist just in OCD. I was again looking at what the kind of life experiences people had been through. Now, not everybody, obviously, who has OCD has experienced trauma. We need to make that really clear. Not everybody has experienced trauma. And that's, you know, that's how it is as well. But many people have experienced quite extensive periods of trauma or aversive life events in their histories. And the research is only just now really backing that up. But it's something that us as clinicians, we've kind of known, and as service users, we've also known for many, many years. But the research is finally catching up there.
Yeah, really good point. So let's define some terms before we get into the meat of it. So trauma can be many things: complex, developmental, PTSD. So I guess let's start with PTSD. So we're going to kind of chop and change between PTSD and like complex developmental trauma. But let's start with PTSD. So what is PTSD?
Okay, so what's PTSD? First of all, somebody, to have a diagnosis of PTSD, somebody has to have experienced a trauma. Now, as you've just indicated, Stuart, there's various definitions out there as to what a trauma is. And that's one of the problems. That's why there's so many different research studies, so different figures and different statistics, because it all depends on how trauma is defined. That's one of the big problems in this area. But the way I define trauma is any life event, aversive life event, that overwhelms us to such an extent that it changes how our nervous system works. And by that, I mean it changes how we think, how we feel, how we behave. And in the case of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, it changes how we process and recall memories as well. But I can give you a bit more detail on that to make sense of it, if that's useful.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so one of the if you have PTSD, not only have you been through a trauma or a series of traumas in the case of complex PTSD, but you have to fulfill certain other diagnostic symptom categories as well. The most well-known one, or the most defining one, if we say the most defining aspect, is re-experiencing. By this, it's often known as flashbacks. out there in the general population. This is where our brain feeds back some of the aspects of that trauma experience we've been through. Usually it's images. So we see intrusive negative images that we're not recalling deliberately, but it also can be things like body sensations as well, or emotions that just come out of the blue. And the key thing here, the key thing about re-experiencing or flashbacks is that they're not like normal memories. We're not remembering something awful that happened in the past, but it has a different quality to it. It actually feels like it's happening again now. So we might be seeing things in our vision, feeling things in our body, feeling different emotions, and it feels as if that trauma is happening now. That's the defining feature of it, of PTSD. There's also three other things that we just need to mention here. One is avoidance. If we have PTSD, we tend to do lots of avoidance of things that trigger our trauma memories. And that's completely understandable, obviously. There's also changes to how we think and how we feel. For example, it's very common, for example, in the case of trauma, for people to have an inflated sense of responsibility for that trauma, even though they may not have been responsible for it at all. And that, you know, has a similarity to OCD there in a way, isn't there? But that could be one example of how our thinking changes. Or we might feel a lot of shame or a lot of guilt as well. So it's changing in emotion as well. And the last one is changes in levels of arousal. And by that, we mean changes in agitation. So, you know, the fight, flight and freeze reactions that people know this by.
Yeah. Yeah. So just even in that list, there's a huge overlap with OCD.
And then,
if someone's experienced PTSD and OCD, it's kind of double fueled.
Double whammy, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And the two often kind of get intermingled, and it's hard to say which is which, really, some of the time.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you about complex or developmental trauma, as the next definition. And I think this is an interesting one because a lot of people will think, well, I've never had any serious, they might use that word, serious, like one-off or repeated events. So I don't have trauma. But of course, trauma doesn't necessarily have to be that. So yeah, if you could just explain complex or developmental trauma.
Sure, absolutely. So complex or developmental trauma, this is where we're talking about several traumatic events. Often they're things that we can't even remember very distinctly in our head. And those are events that just overwhelm our coping resources and again, our nervous system, just as in the case of the more simple kind of trauma that you've just described. But these can be things like being abandoned as a child or not having enough emotional support, or it can be things like having a caregiver who's quite emotionally absent and not there to support us. It could be things like witnessing arguing or physical abuse of somebody else happening, particularly when we're growing up. All these things affect us a lot more during the developmental period of when we're a child, because our brain is developing at that point. So these things affect us a lot more than perhaps they would, you know, to an adult if those same things were happening to an adult. So those are some of the things that could make up complex trauma. And of course, we've got the more obvious things as well, like childhood sexual abuse or a childhood physical abuse, neglect, those kind of things as well.
Yeah, really good points. So thank you for defining those. Yeah, so with trauma, what's going on in the brain? How can we understand it?
So that's really interesting. And what we're going to do is just simplify it a bit down. First of all, Stuart, can you just imagine that you've got an upstairs brain? That's all the bit on the top of your head from your forehead going right back to the back of your head. And you've also got a downstairs brain, and they do different things. So the upstairs brain, that's where Stuart is. So that's the bit where Stuart makes decisions. That's where he decides what to do with his day. That's where he has all his values and decides what to do in the future. It's also the bit that understands words and understands time. It's his intelligent bit, and that's where his sense of self is. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it's the bit that's asking these questions to you and that logged on to Zoom today and all of that. Yeah,
absolutely.
Is it fair to say it's the intelligent part?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the intelligent bit of the brain. That's the bit that defines Stuart as being a human. And same with all of us, yeah. And then also we've got a downstairs brain. This does different things. So it does all the automated bits, all the things we don't have to think about. So it's the bit that keeps us alive. It keeps our heart beating. Yeah. And it does all our bodily functions and all our automatic reactions. And in particular, it's the bit that's in charge with survival. So it's the bit that produces the fight and flight and freeze reactions. So if you imagine that you're crossing the road one day, Stuart, and suddenly you're just about to be hit by a bus, what happens? Do you have to think about it and think, oh, there's a bus coming towards me. What do I need to do? What happens?
I either try and jump out of the way, or maybe I'll freeze in fear. I don't think I'll try and punch the bus. I don't think a fight's going to come in at that point.
No, but you've made some really good points there in that you go straight into the fight, flight, freeze bit of your brain. Mm. You're not stood there thinking about buses and what you need to do. Your body takes over. In other words, the downstairs brain, the automated bit of the brain takes over to hopefully get you out of the way and to keep you safe. So that's the bit of the brain that's in charge with all that. And also just to remember there that that bit of brain, of course, doesn't do complicated things like language or words or time. That's the job of the upstairs brain, the bit that's Stuart. So when something aversive happens, particularly when something traumatic happens, what happens is that all the brain resources go down to the downstairs brain. In other words, the downstairs brain hijacks us and takes over. So at that moment, we can't think what to do because our downstairs brain is making all those decisions for us. And that's a really important point to make, I think, particularly when people have been through trauma and maybe they've done things that they don't think are consistent with who they are as a person, or they feel very shameful about or guilty about, or they just think they've made the wrong decision. It's really important to remember that they actually didn't make the decision. It was their downstairs brain. It was their nervous system that made the decision for them.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, side note from trauma, I use the upstairs, downstairs brain with every client with OCD to talk about the amygdala and the downstairs brain, and how if we try and kind of reason and rationalize with that downstairs brain, it just can't understand the words we're saying. So that's why it doesn't work. And that's we need to show it. That's the only way we can get that behavior change, is to show the downstairs brain. Exactly. And then it will calm down. And
yeah, we need to show, not tell.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's the same with trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm. We need to show, not tell. Yeah, there's a certain amount we can do with talking, absolutely. But there's a lot of stuff we need to do as well in order to process trauma.
Really good point. So let's get into some of that. So how often do you see or have you seen either PTSD or any trauma alongside OCD?
A lot. The research tells us that about 4% to 22% of people with PTSD, that's people with PTSD, not just having experienced a trauma, but people with a official diagnosis of PTSD, have OCD as well. So that's 4 to 22%. But about, the research also tells us that between 50 and 80% of people with OCD have reported at least one significant trauma in their lives. And certainly my own clinical practice supports that. It's probably at the upper end of that. 80% or more of people, I would say, who have OCD have one or more significant traumas. But I think the difference in the figures there come back to that fact we talked about right at the beginning, that it does depend on how you define trauma. If you have quite a narrow definition of to experience a trauma, you must have experienced death, serious injury, or sexual violence, then it's at the lower end. But if we have a more realistic definition, which includes all the complex trauma that we've talked about as well, all that developmental trauma, then it's going to be at the upper end of that.
Yeah.
Nearer to 80% or maybe even higher.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, really, really good point. And I think what's interesting for me is if it's the clinicians and researchers defining what trauma is, it takes away from the individual. So you could take two people that are unique individuals, experience the same quote-unquote trauma, and for one person, that it doesn't bother them, they're fine about it, maybe they don't like it, but it doesn't cause them that, it doesn't change the nervous system. But for the other person who's maybe naturally more sensitive, genetically, or you know, that's going to cause the trauma. So it's if we say, oh no, this isn't trauma because that's not that bad, it really depends on the individual.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm totally there with you. In fact, one of the biggest predictors for having PTSD in response to a trauma in adulthood, like a car crash, is having lots of other traumas or, you know, aversive life events as a child as well. So I think that's falling into what you're saying there, that all the experiences we ever had are contributing to, you know, how sensitive we are or how ready for action we are when other bad things hit us. And that kind of goes for OCD as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so does disgust play a role in trauma and OCD?
Absolutely, disgust. So it's there in both of them. And actually, if we just go to the research for a moment, the research is suggesting that people who've been through sexual traumas or childhood sexual abuse are at increased risk of having contamination-related OCD. And that goes for external contamination OCD, you know, worries about germs and viruses and asbestos and that sort of thing, but also mental contamination, that sense that we're just disgusting or gross or that we can infect people just by being us. So it's related, very much related to that. And also there's other research that says that there's other sorts of OCD are also, that other traumas are also related to an increased disgust reaction that can lead to contamination OCD as well. Yeah, so disgust is very, very crucial. Yeah. And I think it's an often missed thing. Clinicians often miss that.
Yeah, we tried to talk a bit about that on the podcast in recent months because historically we focus on anxiety, but for some people, the guilt or disgust or shame can be as powerful a driver as the anxiety is for OCD.
I think so. So it's important to just be aware of all of those things. It's mental distress and, you know, physiological distress rather than just honing in on anxiety that we need to be. You're quite right there, Stuart. Absolutely spot on.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. So next one, obviously doubt and uncertainty play into OCD. Most of my listeners will know that and experience it on a daily basis. Does it factor into trauma too?
Absolutely. I mean, if we look at the kind of cognitive biases that if we have OCD, and I'm counting myself there as well, let's just go through some of them. So we've got inflated responsibility. That's the first one. But we've also got overestimation of threat. We've also got intolerance of uncertainty, need for control over our thoughts. We tend to put an overimportance on our thoughts. And there are also, in some people, some of us, that tends to be a tendency towards perfectionism or need to control actions or the external environment. And all of those things are there in PTSD as well, potentially. And even if a person doesn't meet the diagnostic criteria for PTSD, but they've experienced trauma, then cognitive biases tend to be there as well. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. It's interesting. So with sort of doubt, uncertainty, disgust from trauma alongside OCD, how does this complicate treatment? I guess, and more generally, like just trauma alongside OCD, how does that complicate treatment?
Well, I think we've got to be kind of careful there because sometimes, absolutely, it can complicate treatment. Yeah. But I think if you get a clinician that understands both and is able to formulate them both together, in other words, understand them both together, then it doesn't necessarily have to complicate the therapy. Because sometimes people feel a bit hopeless thinking, well, I've got OCD and I've got PTSD as well, and this is really bad. But sometimes if we just understand them together and make sense of them as one, it can feel a lot easier, a lot simpler, and feel a lot more straightforward, you know, to know what to do treatment-wise. So I think it's really important that we don't necessarily think it's going to complicate it. But yeah, indeed, it can lengthen the therapy journey sometimes. We can say that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's about having a little bit of patience as well and just being really super kind to yourself, super compassionate to yourself, but really understanding why, you know, you've developed these kind of issues with OCD, you know. And a lot of the time, of course, they're soothing techniques. They're things where the compulsions are things that we're using to try and soothe ourselves in the short term. But of course, that's leading to a long term, you know, not a disadvantage for us. You know, the solutions that we're trying to put forward are actually becoming the problems, as we say.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I realized as that question left my mouth, it sounded much more negative than I wanted it to be. But yeah, no, that's really good to hear and agree. It all comes back to that formulation of understanding how each thing factors into another. Because I think with diagnoses, we can look at each one as this separate organism or entity. And of course, the brain doesn't have neat boxes. It's loads of neurons wired together.
That's right. And they're so interrelated. Mm. And that's one of the conversations I have with people I supervise quite a lot, because one of their questions is, which shall I treat first? And yeah, I mean, I'm guessing there are situations where things need to be treated separately, but most of the time we'd be treating them together because they're functionally related, because the compulsions are functioning, to give us that false sense of safety or false sense of comfort or security, but not actually healing us in the long term. In fact, getting in the way of doing what we want to do with our life big time. So understanding them for what they are is where we need to be.
Absolutely. And do you see that the compulsions, so we know compulsions make OCD worse in the long run.
Yeah.
Does it also feed back into the trauma and make that worse, or at least maintain it?
It can do, yeah. So because when the brain is flagging up intrusive images for us and we're having flashbacks. Now, clearly those are really very, very distressing and very unpleasant to be in. But what the brain is trying to do when it's doing that to us is trying to help us process that trauma. In other words, trying to help us put words around that trauma so it can be stored away properly in that upstairs brain where we can access it as something that belongs in the past. That's what the brain's trying to do. But every time we're getting those intrusions or that horrible sense of fight and flight that comes up in our body, that adrenaline rushing around our body and we're feeling all trembly and on edge, if every time we're getting that feeling, we go into a self-soothing mechanism like hand washing or checking or counting or one of our OCD compulsions, that can actually stop our brain from doing the very job it needs to do. So that's why it can be a little bit complicated, and we need to, you know, really get hold of a super good therapist who can understand both of them with us compassionately, kindly, and help us take the actions that we need to take to not do those compulsions.
Yeah, yeah, really good point. So you mentioned compassion a couple of times, so I'll leave that as an open question. How does compassion for you come into the room with these two labels?
Yeah, it's so important. And with all mental health work, because basically, if we have a mental health problem, then what we're probably doing is beating ourselves up and really being hard on ourselves, possibly being quite threatening to ourselves. And you know that doesn't work. If being hard on yourself worked, I'd tell people to be hard on themselves. But it doesn't. It actually makes things a shed load worse because it increases the threat reaction in our brain. It's a bit like being in a fight and then hitting yourself instead of the opponent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So being compassionate, you know, first of all, I'm really owning that as a therapist, trying to be compassionate and modeling that. But, you know, having, you know, if we've got some of these issues ourselves, being compassionate to ourselves, that's the first step in the journey.
Yeah.
Basically, throughout our life, we've been trying our best. We really have. We've been trying our best with the resources that we've had available to us. Mm. So we need to own that. We've been doing our best. Yeah. And, you know, now we might have come to the point that we're ready to deal with some of this stuff. We need to be really compassionate about that too, that, yeah, we're taking this courageous step forward. And yes, it's hard. It's really hard. And yeah, we need to be really kind to ourselves, as well as, you know, pushing ourselves to really good action that will take our lives where we want to be.
Yeah, really good point. Yeah, absolutely. And will you spend in the early days of therapy, and obviously it's going to depend person to person, but generally speaking, will you spend some time working on compassion for themselves?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I think it's mainly, it's not a specific bit of therapy that, oh, we're doing the compassion bit here, but I think it's just very much interwoven throughout the whole therapy. So when we're doing a formulation and understanding, you know, why have I got OCD? Why am I doing these trauma things? Why am I having intrusive thoughts in my head and intrusive images and horrible senses in my body that come from that experience I had when I was five? You know, it's about being really compassionate, even at that, you know, very much at that moment, to help help people understand where all this comes from and what we need to do about it going forward.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, thank you. So this question is obviously going to be, it's going to differ for each client you work with, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But how are you working on the OCD therapy-wise, whether that's ERP or something else, and then also trauma alongside? So just thinking of how are you calming that nervous system through therapy?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So we mentioned earlier about the upstairs brain and downstairs brain, and you say that you're using that in your therapy with OCD as well, and that's brilliant. That's music to my ears. That's brilliant. So first of all, understanding things from that point of view first, what's happening in the brain can really help soothe us in a good way, because it's cutting out some of that external threat that comes from our feelings of shame and guilt about having PTSD or about having OCD. So that would be my first step, very much. And when you remove some of that kind of secondary shame or guilt, you know, the things people beat themselves up from, people, you know, the brain is in a slightly less threatened state. So we might have less need, therefore, to do quite so much OCD to soothe ourselves in the short term. And then it's about explicitly talking about the function of the compulsions and how they take away, you know, how they lead to the problem continuing. We know that well in OCD. So just to go through that in detail with people, and again, the compassionate way, so that they understand and don't feel, you know, hard on themselves about it. And yeah, basically encouraging people just to stop doing some of those compulsions, to experiment with what happens when I stop washing my hands following touching the dog, let's say, or what happens if I have a bad thought in my head that I might push an old lady in a road? What happens if I just let that thought be there and just walk on by past her? That sort of thing.
Yeah. I like that. I guess the question that's coming to my mind is, I've seen before with clients that with trauma and OCD, they sometimes didn't want to work on a particular OCD theme because it intertwined with the trauma. So some of the OCD felt like it was quite separate, but at least the content was separate. And then some of the content very much overlaps specifically with the trauma.
Right. No, I know what you mean.
That's true. So it's how do you kind of encourage them still to move towards that? Because of course they need to cut out the compulsions.
Yeah.
But it's so, basically not wanting to be mean to oneself was
No, absolutely. Again, I think the first step is through understanding. Now, I'm thinking of a lady that I worked with, and she has given me permission to talk about her stuff in training, but she was a lady who'd been in a house fire, and she'd lost an awful lot. I won't go into the details about it, but yeah, there's a lot of trauma that came from this house fire, but that led directly to her then starting to check electrical equipment, ovens, anything that could possibly cause house fires in her new house. So although she had some other OCD as well, that was the one that she was really clinging on to because it was so functionally related, so obviously related to the trauma that she'd been through. So again, it's about really drilling down compassionately to understanding why her nervous system, why her lower brain, downstairs brain, doesn't want to let go to that, go of that, because it thinks it's so crucial to her staying alive. And at the same time, just unpicking how these things are actually taking her away from her goal of living her life in the way that she wants to. So it's kind of like a double prong approach here. One is through understanding, but then the other bit is just working out what the costs are of her continuing to do all this checking for, well, she was doing it for about 8 hours a day, and what that was preventing her from doing in her life, how she wasn't able to do the kind of things she dreamed of doing with her life because all this checking was going on. So although she was doing it to try and keep herself alive, it was actually stopping her living in the way she wanted to. And it was kind of when she got to that point, that was when she was able to let go of it, that the checking was stopping her living in the way she wanted to.
So it
was sort of moving towards something rather than moving away from something. Maybe I just need to clarify about that, because sometimes when we're, as therapists, we're really guilty of this. We focus too much on fighting against the OCD or fighting against the trauma, rather than fighting for what we want in our lives going forward.
Yeah.
The kind of dreams that we might have had for ourselves when we were younger, the things that really fuel us, the things that make us alive, the things that make us buzz. We've got to find those. Yeah, we all have to find those, but particularly if we've been through trauma and have OCD, we need to refine them.
Yeah.
I feel really strongly about that.
I agree completely. And that's why I like acceptance and commitment therapy, because they focus a lot on values and what do you want to be different? How would you be living your life? And obviously that's not exclusive to ACT, but they make a very explicit attempt at it. Over the years of doing this podcast, I've heard so many people say, well, you know, I got better from OCD. I stopped doing 5 hours worth of compulsions a day. And then I had a new problem. I didn't know what to do with my life. I had all this time and I was miserable. And it's like probably because they hadn't worked in therapy, or the therapist hadn't. What do you want to do now? How do you want your life to be different? What do you want to spend your time doing? And maybe that would have addressed that issue for them.
Absolutely. No, I'm so there with you, Stuart, really. Yeah, because often there's a kind of grief that comes out.
That's it.
When the OCD, when we're not doing the compulsions anymore, there's a kind of sense of huge loss about the life we haven't lived, and also a loss about where we want to go going forward. So I feel really strongly about that. We need to focus on values and what we want for ourselves. I'm with you there.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, agreed. So that's all my questions. Is there anything, on trauma, is there anything else on trauma and OCD that you wanted to say today or share?
So one of the things about trauma that I think we just need to be hyper aware of is because it's where a lot of the shame comes from that people feel when they've been through trauma, whether that's a one-off trauma or whether it's developmental trauma, things that happen when we're growing up. And that's the freeze reaction. And I think the freeze reaction, it's particularly interesting because people use it in different ways. People use it in different ways. So when we're going through an aversive life event, particularly a trauma, let's just say like a car crash or something, Stuart, we have a miniature freeze reaction at the time. We know this because time seems to slow down when we're in the middle of something, and also we go into tunnel vision, so we notice things very specifically. So that's one type of the freeze reaction, but it's a thing that lasts very briefly. But the thing that people mainly talk about when they're saying a freeze reaction, this is very, very, very common, particularly in interpersonal trauma, when we've been attacked or perhaps raped or abused in some way. That's when we go into a state called tonic immobility. Tonic means stiff, so our muscles go into a really stiff, paralyzed kind of reaction. And immobility just means immobile. We can't move. In fact, it's like being paralyzed. In fact, I was talking to a lady the other day, and her analogy for this, and she'd been attacked, was that it felt like being under a general anesthetic, but awake. Yeah. So she was completely aware of what was going on, but utterly unable to move her body. And this was particularly shameful, she felt, because she'd always thought of herself as the kind of person who, if she was attacked, she would hit the person, or she'd run away from the person, or she would scream or do something to protect herself. But when it came down to it, that's not the choice that her nervous system took. Remember, it's not her making this decision, it's her nervous system or a lower brain. And so her body went into tonic immobility. So by talking through what happens in the brain when we go through a trauma, she was better able to understand it and bring a bit of compassion to herself. And we were able to work through that actually this was her nervous system making the best choice, because she was attacked by somebody who was much, much bigger than herself, far, far stronger. So had she tried to scream or struggle or kick or shout or whatever, she may well have got more injured than she actually did. So her body and her brain were making the decision for her that could best protect her. Rather than risk even more harm to her. But when we worked through that, she felt a lot of relief about it, and also more compassion to herself. Yes. So I think it's really, really important to understand, yeah, the freeze reaction and how we can release some of the shame from that just by understanding it differently.
Yeah, it wasn't her choice or anyone else's choice to freeze.
That's it.
It's automatic.
It was automatic. It was her nervous system making the decision for her.
Yeah,
that's it. And there's another thing that people often call freeze as well, which actually isn't freeze. It's more like a flop. It's when our muscles go into a floppy state. And that's often associated with feeling very, very numb and dissociated or zoned out. And our brain just kind of stops working. And that's actually the opposite from what happens in an acute trauma, sometimes in the time just seems to stop. We're kind of not aware of the passage of time and we just go off into another place. And that's often associated with either trauma that's gone on a very long time or has been repeated, perhaps in the case of domestic violence again and again and again, or particularly when trauma has happened when you're very small. Perhaps your body and brain have got very used to responding in that way because of the things you've been through when you were tiny, and now something else triggers off. It could be something completely unrelated. It could be something like a car crash or, you know, tripping up or something or falling over. But we go automatically into that zoned out state. So that's another thing that happens that's to do with trauma, in particular complex trauma.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. A few different questions now. You could pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Heather. What do you tell her?
The 20-year-old Heather.
Yeah.
Oh, heavens, that was ages ago. Just got to think back there for a minute. Okay. I used to do a lot of ruminating. And a lot of thinking. So I would take a bit of my own medicine and tell myself compassionately, obviously, hopefully in the way I talk to my own clients now, really kind way, that, Heather, you're doing too much ruminating and not enough action. So let's stop the ruminating and start getting you taking action that will actually help you do something that matters, that will get you doing something that will change some of these, disrupt some of these thinking patterns in your brain, and stop them eventually through taking action, doing things that matter.
Yes, I like it. and you've got a billboard wherever you live. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
For everyone to see. I guess it's got to be consistent with that. It would probably be do what matters. Yeah. Do what matters.
Nice. Yes. I like it. Yeah. And then lastly, anything else you wish you could have said about trauma, OCD, or just anything?
I don't think so. I think we've been through a fair range of things here, Stuart. I'll probably think of lots when we finish the call here. But no, it's been really interesting and a real pleasure to go through this with you and talk it through. So thank you. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. This one's been action-packed with lots of stuff and science and information. So I think it's going to resonate with a lot of people. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.